This is Columbia in New York. We're expecting momentarily to switch to London for the number 2 communique from Supreme Headquarters Allied Expeditionary Forces. We're informed it will be available shortly. Meanwhile, here is a summary of the news to this moment. Reporting the European invasion up to schedule, President Roosevelt announced today the loss of 2 United States destroyers and an LST, landing ship tanks, in the first push. These covered ships reported lost up to noon today, he told his news conference, adding aircraft losses were approximately 1%. A reporter asked the president whether the Tehran conference decided the place as well as the time for the invasion. Laughing, Mr. Roosevelt said, there were half a dozen places. Are there still half a dozen places? The president said the questioner knew his question was improper. Allied invasion forces drove 10 miles through the German Atlantic wall defenses today and entered the communications center of Caen after seizing several key bridges in northern France. Constantly reinforced Allied armies, supported by the biggest air and sea armadas in history, plunged into Festung Europa at perhaps a dozen points along a widening front after apparently resting solid beachheads on the shores of the Normandy Peninsula. Paratroopers who spearheaded the initial landings were reported by the Nazi-controlled Paris radio to be dropping in great numbers north of Rouen, 40 miles from the coast. The Vichy radio told of great masses of Allied planes slashing at German defenses in the Calais and Dunkirk area and reported violent naval action thundering off the French coast in the narrowest part of the English Channel. Prime Minister Winston Churchill declared that American, British, and Canadian forces have penetrated several miles inland in some cases. Thus far, invasion losses have been unexpectedly light. The German radio admitted that Allied forces had seized a beachhead some 16 and a half miles long by a few miles deep in the Villers-sur-Mer Trouville area. The London radio stated that the invasion front in France was sufficiently broad by evening to be more than a bridgehead. As the invasion forces smashed ahead, Supreme Invasion Commander General Dwight D. Eisenhower revealed that bad weather had postponed the invasion 24 hours from Monday to Tuesday morning. The general, summarizing the first day's operations, said that the gigantic Allied armies under Field Commander General Sir Bernard Montgomery had surmounted the first 4 or 5 obstacles. Surmounting of these obstacles was aided by an unprecedented bombardment of German coast defenses from the huge sea armada and by hordes of Allied bombers. Ferried across the English Channel by a great armada of 4,000 ships and thousands of lighter craft, and screened from above by a thundering fleet of 11,000 Allied warplanes, American, British, and Canadian troops hit the beaches along the front of roughly 100 miles between Cherbourg and Le Havre in the first cloudy hours of daylight and swept swiftly inland. Allied losses in the initial assault were much lighter than had been anticipated, and there was an unmistakable air of optimism at the headquarters of General Dwight D. Eisenhower, Supreme Allied Commander. It was disclosed that D-Day originally had been set for Monday, but bad weather forced a day's postponement. Tonight, a German news broadcast announced the Allies held a front from 10 to 15 miles broad along the Normandy coast and from a half mile to nearly a mile deep. Prime Minister Churchill announced that Allied airborne troops had captured several strategic bridges inside France before the enemy could destroy them, and that there is even fighting proceeding in the town of Caen. Caen is 9 miles inland, near the base of the Cherbourg Peninsula, west and slightly south of Le Havre. Airborne troops are well established, and the follow-ups are proceeding with very much less loss than we expected, Churchill told a cheering House of Commons in his second report of the day. Many dangers and difficulties, which this time last night appeared extremely formidable, are behind us. This operation is proceeding in a thoroughly satisfactory manner. The German-controlled Paris radio broadcast a last-minute flash from the battlefield early tonight, saying that a vicious battle is raging north of Rouen between powerful Allied paratroop formations and German anti-invasion forces. Rouen is 41 miles from the coast east of Le Havre. In an earlier report, Churchill told Commons that the Allied assault was proceeding according to plan. And what a plan! we hope to finish the enemy with a succession of surprises during the course of the fighting. We still expect the number 2 communique of the Allied invasion to be broadcast from London momentarily. While we're waiting for it, here is a further summary of the day's developments. Parachute and glider-borne troops, who led the history-making attack in thousands of pre-dawn landings deep within the enemy's vaunted defenses, suffered extremely small losses in the air, headquarters announced, and seaborne losses were described as very, very small. Nazi coastal defenses had been silenced until they offered only sporadic fire, and Allied air power completely dominated the battle area. Several of the toughest invasion hurdles had been successfully cleared, but an Allied spokesman warned that many more remain. Huge Allied reinforcements of men and armor were pouring ashore tonight. Fixed German guns along the coast were literally blown apart by a 10,000-ton aerial barrage in the 8 hours preceding the landings, and then a formidable fleet of American and British warships, including battleships with 16-inch rifles, stood close inshore and destroyed enemy bunkers and gun positions with point-blank fire. Despite a command by Reichsmarschall Hermann Göring that the invasion must be beaten off even if the Luftwaffe perishes, only 50 German planes appeared in the early hours of the attack. Allied fighters ranged 75 miles inland without meeting opposition. The German radio reported bitter fighting at a half dozen points in Normandy and claimed to have identified 2 U.S. airborne divisions in the Cherbourg Peninsula and 2 British airborne divisions in the Seine area near Le Havre. First to report that the invasion was underway early today, the Nazis speculated that the Normandy assault merely was diversionary in nature and declared the invasion troops were going into an inferno, comparison with which Dante's hell was child's play. The enemy broadcasters said German reinforcements were being rushed to meet the onslaught and that counterattacks already had been struck. Churchill, though his night report to Commons was extremely optimistic in the main, warned that the day's fighting gives no indication whatever of what may be the course of the battle in the next days and weeks, because the enemy will now probably endeavor to concentrate on this area. In that event, heavy fighting will soon begin and will continue. It is therefore a most serious time that we are entering upon. In addition to the heavy counterattacks expected to be launched by German ground troops within a matter of days or even hours, it also was anticipated that the Nazi air force would pitch violently into the battle soon. The Germans are estimated to have probably 1,750 fighters and 500 bombers available for the defense of the West. By comparison, the great Allied plane fleets, which led the assault before dawn today, extended across 200 miles of sky and used navigation lights to maintain formation. Headquarters tonight praised troop carriers of the 9th Air Force for having conducted very large-scale airborne operations with very small losses. The sky was black with them as they headed for France, said an American fighter pilot. He said a thick overcast up to 7,000 feet might have contributed to keeping the German Air Force on the ground. Other airmen told of seeing Allied ground troops hit the beaches and literally run inland through the shattered enemy defenses. More than 640 Allied naval guns, ranging from 4 to 16 inches, participated in the pulverizing bombardment of the Atlantic Wall, the most photographed and publicized belt of defenses the world has ever known. Churchill said the Nazi shore batteries were largely quelled before an Allied soldier landed. Only a few enemy destroyers and motor torpedo boats attempted to interfere with the vast Allied fleet. Preceding the actual invasion fleet across the channel was a huge armada of little ships, minesweepers, which swept lanes straight to the designated landing points. The length of sweep wires used to tear loose the moored German mines stretched nearly 70 miles in all, the greatest minesweeping job in history. Some of the ships used still are on the secret list. After the sweepers, in amazingly ordered confusion, came the whole flat-bottomed family of landing craft, laden with fighting men, guns, tanks, shells, field rations, hypodermics, radio sets, bandages, trucks, and other bewildering baggage of combat. An Associated Press correspondent reported the morale of American troops was amazingly high as the invasion fleet prepared to move across the channel. "Most of them never have been in battle before," he wrote, "but their ranks are toughened by a hard core of veterans who learned to fight across the battlegrounds of the Mediterranean. The troops entered their ships at noon yesterday and then passed the hours reading, arguing, playing cards, or rolling dice. Eisenhower, after having personally inspected and wished luck to a unit of airborne troops, addressed a ringing message to all the Allied invasion forces in which he declared, "We will accept nothing less than full victory." Then, from a housetop somewhere on the English coast, the commander watched the great spectacle unfold. Leading all Allied ground troops in the invasion was General Sir Bernard L. Montgomery, Britain's most famed field commander, who whipped Marshal Erwin Rommel on the sands of Africa. He predicted 3 weeks ago that Rommel would try to knock us back into the sea. He described Rommel as a disruptor and forecast that to disrupt the invasion, he will try to hit us early. In a pre-battle message to his troops, Montgomery told them, "To us is given the honor of fighting a blow for freedom which will live in history, and in the better days that lie ahead, men will speak with pride of our doing. I want every soldier to know that I have complete confidence in the successful outcome of the operations that we are now about to begin. Good luck to each one of you, and good hunting on the mainland of Europe." Wielding sheath knives and Tommy guns, thousands of American and British paratroopers and glider troops swept down on sleeping Cherbourg Peninsula out of the pre-dawn blackness and immediately set about the tasks of disrupting Nazi rear lines by destroying key bridges, rail yards, and enemy strong points. At headquarters late today, a military spokesman praising troop carrier planes which navigated through a rainy, stormy night to drop thousands of these specially trained soldiers on vital objectives said, "The operation was on a very large scale and was carried out with great precision. Our losses in aircraft were extremely small. It was a fine job, very fine indeed." As the airborne troops are fighting fiercely well behind the enemy lines, the spokesman naturally was not in a position to give a detailed picture of the results of their landings. But reports from air observers indicated they carried the brunt of the battle in the early stages, creating large diversions and as much damage as possible. Attack bombers flying back over the area in which the airborne troops landed reported seeing a number of demolitions and many burning buildings. The German radio gave the first hint of the scope of this epochal operation. The broadcast claimed the soldiers had been identified as from four divisions, which were named as the 1st and 6th British and the 28th and 100th American. Allied military authorities withheld comment on the size of the landing force. Before taking off, these crack troops were wished Godspeed by Supreme Commander General Eisenhower, who spent 7 hours touring airdromes from which the air troops took off. After chatting with them and eating donuts and coffee at one of their headquarters, Eisenhower climbed to a roof and watched as squadron after squadron climbed into the sky, their destination France. A bulletin just received from Reuters News Agency says the U.S. 9th Air Force aircraft flew more than 2,500 individual missions before 1 p.m. today in the most violent 12 hours of aerial warfare in history. Preceding by minutes the first seaborne troops to cross the channel, 9th Air Force Marauder crews, briefed at 10 p.m. Eastern wartime, took off in the semi-darkness in a cold driving rain to batter coastal defenses and gun emplacements on the French shore. 16 250-pound bombs each and flying at altitudes down to 4,000 feet, the lowest level they have operated from in more than a year, the Marauders attacked their targets in 8 waves and left many of the guns out of action before the first assault of ground troops arrived. Associated Press war correspondent Gladwin Hill, flying in the landing area shortly after 6 a.m., reported that inland hundreds of parachutes plopped neatly in fields without a sign of life about, testified eloquently to the alacrity with which their riders plunged into cover to tangle with Germans. The concentration of chutes in model landing places was cheering evidence of smoothness with which the operation came off. Later, Associated Press photographer Bede Irwin told of seeing thousands of red and dark green camouflage parachutes lying about on the ground during the flight across the Cherbourg Peninsula. There was also about a 500-acre section packed with gliders, he said. A number had cracked up, but most seemed to have gotten down okay. From our height, I couldn't see any ground movement, but many buildings in the area were burning. There must have been quite a battle. For this climactic moment, the spearheading airborne troops spent months in secret, arduous training. Besides ankle sheath knives and rapid-fire weapons, they carried bandoliers of ammunition, hand grenades, coils of rope, pick handles, spades, and rubber dinghies. The last in case of plane failure over the channel. Some of the paratroopers, looking like Indians on the warpath with their faces stained reddish-brown with cocoa and linseed oil, said that they had put on the camouflage so we'll have something to eat if our rations run out. The quip told to Eisenhower made the Supreme Commander laugh quite heartily. Normandy, whose broad beaches were chosen by the Allied commanders as offering the best chance of success, forms a natural peninsula, a pathway into France. The peninsula ranges from 25 to 60 miles wide and is 70 miles long, with the port of Cherbourg at its tip. Allied penetrations inland would clear all of Norway with its many airfield sites and provide a pathway down the Seine Valley to Paris. Le Havre, 100 airline miles northwest of Paris on the Seine River estuary, is France's second airport, with 14 ship basins and 8 miles of docks. The German DNB news agency said the invasion began with the dropping of major airborne formations between the estuaries of the Seine and the Orne in the area of Isigny, Caen, and near Barfleur, at the northeastern tip of the Cherbourg Peninsula. About 2 hours after the parachutists dropped, the German agency said large-scale amphibious operations began on a wide front between Le Havre and Cherbourg, with very strong disembarkations at the small coastal village of Saint-Vaast-la-Hogue. It said the landings were made behind thick blankets of artificial fog.